This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to Let's Go There with Shira and Ryan, and happy Tuesday, everyone.
Yes, yes, yes. You know, Shira, remember when we were talking about how Wednesdays are slump days? I feel like they're getting, it's like even more, like I think Tuesday has become our new slump day. Like before you know it, it's just going to be Monday and like the week in general. Like you're going to be like, what
no,
is
it's
going
funny.
On?
You know, in the middle of recording, I'll stop, go back to my kitchen and my housemate will be like, how's the show going today? How's the recording? And I was like, you know, it's good. Everything's good, but I was like, it just feels like a Wednesday.
Which, side note, let's be honest, I've heard Shira having those little off conversations before, and honey,
oh, the tea?
Not to,
what?
I not don't to say start anything. No drama, not to start no drama, but yes,
no, the
honey,
best. So when we started,
Shira,
this
think, she'll,
actually,
think her,
wait.
She'll think her mic is off, and Shira will just be going off wait, and talking about, so, it feels like a present.
Oh, this is the best. So when we started recording, we were definitely, you know, going through it when we started recording from home. You know, it was a crazy time. It still is, but now we're more used to it.
Right.
And so, yeah, we were having a bit of our own little, I would say we were having some tension. We were having a little fight. And I went to the kitchen and, you
kept
know.
Kept her mic on in
wait,
the
because
kitchen.
I was hungry and Ryan was like, I'm hungry too. But I'm like, and we had this mm-hmm. argument about taking a moment to get a food break. So I left and I basically under my breath said, oh, what, Ryan thinks this is a prison?
Nah, she didn't say it under her breath. She full on was talking. It's like when you find out, like when your friend is like talking crap about you to another friend and they accidentally send you the text message by accident and then they realize, oh crap, they know it. Yes, honey, that's what happens at Let's Go There.
And then I came back to Zoom and Ryan's like, want to say that to my face? And I was
period.
Like, what? He's like, the prison comment. And I was like, well, I would say it to your face. I'm not
and
hiding
I,
it.
And I'm Black and she want to mention prison? Just joking.
Well, as you see, as you hear, we've gotten past that moment and now we can laugh about it.
We can laugh about it. It's hilarious. Just to give you some insight on what we go through to give y'all such a perfection of a show.
Yeah, a completely functional relationship we have here. Let's get into some what's trending this hour. Speaking of our functional country right now that's completely non-toxic, let's get into this, what's trending this hour. The White House has officially moved to withdraw the U.S. from the World Health Organization, otherwise known as WHO, breaking ties with the global public health body in the middle of a pandemic. Senator Bob Menendez, the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, announced that today the White House did notify Congress that it plans to formally withdraw from WHO. And with that, it requires actually a year's notice, so it will not go into effect until July 6, 2021. But that raises the possibility that it could be reversed, as we all know.
Yeah, this is so weird that the White House, which is in the United States, wants to, I guess, withdraw from WHO. I don't know how this works, and maybe we can break it down. But either way, once Trump is out of office, he can't do nothing about it.
Yeah. And what would be the repercussions of that? Like, why would you want to do that? Because you don't believe in anything? You think it's a waste of time? Like, just like everything
exactly.
else happening in this
exactly.
country? So in discussing reopening schools today, Trump added how far we've come and what's ahead.
Pioneered new treatments that are dramatically improving the health outcomes. Vaccines are doing very well. Therapeutics are doing very well. The therapeutic research has been incredible. And I think you're going to have a lot of big things happening long before the end of the year on both vaccines and therapeutics. Therapeutics is, I guess, a little bit of a word we can use for on the way to a cure. but they make you better. I mean, to me, the therapeutic is even more important than the vaccine at this point, because people will get better. But the numbers are, the testing numbers are the highest they've ever been. We're almost up to 40 million in testing, and 40 million people, which is unheard of, far more than any other country, many times what any other country is. And therefore, we have more cases. Because we're doing more testing, we have more cases.
You know, I love that spin that he keeps on using, Ryan. The more testing, more cases, whole, excuse. Because in June, ProPublica actually researched this theory. And in some states, such as New York, Illinois, and Indiana, where testing had stayed about the same or increased, the share of positive tests had dropped. So that's not actually the case. The more tests you have, the more cases.
Of course. I think everyone is clear that Trump just be talking out of his wee-hoo.
Woo-ha, hoo-ha.
Whatever.
Today, Operation Warp Speed, you know how much I love that name, the federal government's COVID-19 vaccine program announced the largest government COVID-19 vaccine contract to date, a $1.6 billion contract with Novavax, a Maryland biotech company. Well, Stanley Erck, the president and CEO, must be having a heyday. A lot of popping those champagne bottles today. He said Novavax vaccine could be on the market by the first quarter of next year. Now, finally, the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, says the U.S. is looking at banning, this app, your kids are on it, or maybe you are, TikTok and other Chinese social media apps over privacy concerns. So TikTok might no longer be available in the U.S.
Too depressed. Who's going to be depressed? I mean, sure, I knew I was going to have to call your therapist to make sure you were okay after this news dropped.
Listen, one more platform not to keep up with. I think I could live without it. Pompeo said he wouldn't recommend downloading TikTok unless, quote, you want your privacy in the hands of the Chinese Communist Party. That's according to an ABC News Tech Bytes report. They may also apply for a warrant that requires a person suspected of violating the national security law to surrender their travel documents. And that would restrict them from leaving Hong Kong because now they're putting restrictions on Hong Kong. Anyway, it's like a whole thing. So this is a continuation of our fight with obviously China, including restricting their ability to access anything here in the US and obviously our obsession with apps that they have, including TikTok. So we'll see what happens. That was somewhat trending this hour, but coming up, New Jersey and Delaware's primaries are today. What you need to watch out for next. We are back, and New Jersey and Delaware are holding primary elections today, with Delaware having a presidential primary. So what should we be looking out for? Well, Dave Weigel is back with us from the Washington Post. Thanks again for being here today.
Oh, it's good to be back. Thanks, guys.
So let's get into what are the most important things that are happening today that people should be looking out for.
Well, most of the action today, if you want to call this action, but I do, is in New Jersey. They're having every primary today. Now, New Jersey elects the governor in different years, but Cory Booker is going to find out his opponent. Probably not much of a threat to him. I mean, no offense to them, but he's just not somebody being targeted this year by Republicans.
Yeah.
And then Democrats had a really good 2018 in New Jersey where they won four House seats. One of those Democrats switched parties over impeachment, Jeff Van Drew. He's going to get past a challenger, and we're going to find out his opponent. And then there's actually some races against longtime Democratic incumbents by people trying to pull their own Ocasio-Cortez, I should say. And I use that term because people still compare themselves to her to get attention. It kind of works.
Wow. Yeah, I saw a post about campaigns using her branding.
And sometimes with permission, sometimes I wouldn't say if she doesn't want somebody to use her name, she will, but she's very judicious in who she endorses, right? So one race that is interesting, not a lot of money has been spent either way, is Alvio Sirius, who represents Union City, like District 8 in New Jersey, so right over the bridge in from New York. He's never really been challenged. He's got a challenger, Hector Oseguera, who worked for AOC, actually, just a campaign volunteer. But it's one of those things where, like, everyone who just was Woodstock for one day now says they went to Woodstock and did everything there. I mean,
of course.
She had a lot of people who volunteered, they helped out, and that's now kind of their calling card. I'm not trying to mean him. I mean, this is a real candidate who's, I think, the kind of person that actually can pull some upsets. The difference between between New Jersey and New York is the party actually has more control in New Jersey than it does in New York. So, and he hustled and he got his name first on the ballot, right? Which is kind of matters. Sometimes people show up and they just mark whoever's first.
Right.
So the Democrats who backed the incumbent made sure that the line B, you know, so the challenger got line A, and they made sure line B starts with Joe Biden. So people, they did stuff like that. So that's still a race where we're seeing if any of the kind of, it's not even anti-incumbent sentiment. It's more, let's elect somebody closer to the community sentiment. We're seeing if that trickles into New Jersey too.
Okay, and the voice you're hearing is Dave Weigel from the Washington Post, and he literally helps us through all of this stuff that is happening in the political world. I just want to go back to Representative Jeff Van Drew, because you said he switched parties. Can you talk about why he switched parties? Like, what was that decision?
Well, he was always kind of a conservative Democrat on some issues, but he was a longtime New Jersey state senator, so you're not taking a stance on every single national issue if you're there. But he won in 2018, kind of unimpressively for what Democrats thought. I mean, they did much better in other parts of the state, but he won. And then when impeachment was rolling down the tracks, he was against it. There was polling actually done by his opponents that found he was going to lose the primary if he voted against impeachment. So he just switched parties, and he did everything he could to irritate people. I mean, he actually stayed as a Democrat until the vote, so that the vote would reflect a Democrat voting against it, and then he became a Republican.
Ew.
And he even got the president to come to New Jersey to campaign for him. So this understandably irritated Democrats. They had time, and this is not something that happens for every party switch. They actually had time to recruit candidates to run against him. There's a primary between, well, kind of five, but there's only a few people who are really spending the money. Amy Kennedy, who's married to former Congressman Patrick Kennedy. There's Bridget Harrison, who's a college professor that a lot of the party's backing. And then there's some people who ran last time and didn't get a lot of traction. But all of them, I mean, part of the argument is it's not just we want a Democrat to represent us. It's this guy's a phony and all he cares about is protecting this job.
Seems like it. Now, let's talk about the mail-in ballots here. It seems like there were a lot more in Jersey this time around. But I know that in May, supposedly there were some issues. They actually charged four men with election fraud. There were issues with the Postal Service, too. What will change this time around? What are you seeing?
Some of these states I've gone to in person, New Jersey Democrats run everything and they kind of opened up absentee voting. They delayed the primary to allow it. So if it follows the pattern of New York and Maryland and these other states where kind of Democrats got what they wanted, it could just be a while before they finish counting votes. But I have not seen the sort of problems or even worries about problems I saw in other places. I mean, even in Kentucky, where there was kind of a compromise by Democrats, Republicans to allow universal absentee voting, but only a couple of election day polling places, it actually went pretty well in the end. There's always some, and this is a problem people are trying to deal with. There's always some people who return the absentee ballot and it didn't get counted. There's that kind of stuff. But you've not seen the same sort of paranoia that you saw in other states.
So when will we see the results of this one?
That's a hard question. I mean, if you asked me in New York, I would have said we'll see it in a week, and it's been 2 weeks and we might see it tomorrow. So I think this could go faster because there's just fewer votes to count. And this is a state that, the Democrat, I think we'll get enough results tonight to probably call some races, but probably not everything for a while.
All right. And again, Delaware is where the VP Joe Biden is from, too. So that's a fun little fact that people should know about. All right. Thanks again for joining us for this conversation today.
Oh, good to be here. Thanks.
Again, that was Dave Weigel from the Washington Post. Now, coming up, a huge breakthrough in HIV medication might have cured its first positive patient. Details on that next in 10 minutes. Could there be a cure for HIV? Now, these are the headlines making their way around social media today because a 34-year-old male from Brazil with HIV has gone into long-term remission. And that's a lot of hope for a treatment for millions living with the virus. And doctors are reporting that he entered into remission after less than a year into a trial of a new treatment. This is really awesome. And back with us, we have Dr. Michael Sag, professor of medicine and director at the UAB Center for AIDS Research. Thanks again for being here.
Good to be back.
So what does this mean for a potential cure for HIV? Are we there yet?
Short answer, no. It's intriguing. There's some good science and thought behind the program. And to dig into it a little bit, what they did is they had the They had five patients who they tried this protocol on. Four of them didn't have success. When they stopped the treatment afterwards, they all rebounded like most people do. But their one patient, the one individual, now about a year and 2 months out from all of his antiretroviral therapy being stopped, he's still undetectable, and they're not able to find any remnants of the virus and cells circulating in his body. And so they're kind of saying, could this be a cure?
Mm-hmm. But it's not. There's still, it seems like, a lot of different things to take into account.
Right. So let me just kind of quickly run through the questions. One, what about in the lymphoid tissue where the virus really hangs out? So in the other case where there was a cure after bone marrow transplant, which is aggressive, they did biopsies of lymphoid material in the colon, but also the bone marrow and other places, and found absolutely no evidence. And that took them about 6 or 7 years of follow-up to kind of prove that. So this guy's about a year into follow-up, and that stuff hasn't been done yet. The second thing is whether or not this just improved his immune system to control the virus. We know there's a lot of folks, actually about 1% of all people with HIV, who without any treatment at all have no detectable virus in their bloodstream, as if they're on therapy, but they're not. They're called elite controllers. So another question is, did this person through this program become an elite controller, but not quite eliminate all remnants of the virus from his body?
Now, that's interesting because I really want to touch in them. Obviously, we're in the COVID-19 era, right? And according to NBC News, data from last year shows that 38 million people worldwide are now infected with HIV, and that's a million more than in 2018. What kind of setbacks are we going to see when it comes to AIDS and obviously COVID-19? What type of setbacks are we seeing with people trying to get treatment and they obviously can't because of everything happening?
Yeah, COVID has messed up a lot of things in our lives, and treatment of HIV is one on the list for sure. I'm seeing new patients diagnosed still with HIV, and we're getting them into care, and it's kind of working out. But I mean, everyone's got their eye off the ball. They're looking at COVID, and they're not necessarily focused on HIV the way that we need to really bring it under control. PrEP clinics are struggling. Regular clinics have gone to a lot of telemedicine, and some cases that might be good. Some people who don't like going to the clinic, that works. But for other people, they need that connection, and that's missing for some.
Yeah, we are talking again to Dr. Michael Sag, professor of medicine and the director at the UAB Center for AIDS Research. He's been doing this work for so long.
Yes,
he's basically an icon. Mm-hmm. That's really scary, though, if we're seeing this uptick, I'm sure. So as someone who's been in this space for a long time, what needs to change?
In terms of cure research or?
Well, I think both. I think, you know, everyone's looking for a cure, as we've seen. We are excited about this news today, but then also to make sure that we're not going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, I think we all just, again, need to refocus. Hopefully, we're going to find a way in all of our communities to really create pathways for patients that's clear about how they can stay engaged in care and how they can continue to get their medicines without interruption. Those are the things that are job one. But even beyond that, as we all know, people are struggling with other issues, mental health challenges, sometimes substance abuse. And so they need to have the support systems that most of the clinics in the United States for sure provide. And since they're not able to necessarily get into the clinics like they normally do, I'm a little bit concerned that it's just an extra burden on people and an extra burden on the clinic.
But does it concern you when, like, the United Nations AIDS Agency is saying that the global HIV target set for 2020 will not be reached? Even the gains made could be lost and progress further stalled if we fail to act. Like, what do you feel when you hear something like that?
It's concerning. I mean, I'm demoralized by that. I'd love to see us. We were making great progress worldwide, and even in the U.S. when we had our commitment to reduce the AIDS transmission, HIV transmission in the country by up to 75% or 90% by 10 years or so. That was exciting. We were all energized. And then this COVID just took the air out of the balloon, where we're now just struggling to maintain exactly what we had before. So it's a setback for sure.
So for our listeners who are wondering, are the HIV clinics, are they opening back up?
Generally, yes, but with all kinds of precautions. But yes, we're open now, and we're going back face-to-face visits as opposed to a lot of telephone or video visits. So we're getting back to normal.
That was Dr. Michael Sagg, professor of medicine and director at the UAB Center for AIDS Research. Love having him on. Now, coming up, your tweets could have the power to predict COVID-19 surges, but what cost to your privacy? We discuss that next in 10 minutes. Welcome back to the show. Now, could social media and digital algorithms predict coronavirus surges? Okay, wrap your head around this one. In a paper published last week on arxiv.org, pretty futuristic, researchers created this predictive model that could identify coronavirus outbreaks 2 weeks before they happen. And that would help elected officials and public health experts address the problem before it gets out of hand. Now, I
granted
think this is,
that public officials what? Actually took it seriously and actually was like, oh, this is a warning. Yeah. Maybe we should listen to that, because if we look in the past, that has not happened. They had thought it was like labeled as a hoax. So who knows?
Well, yeah, they're not even trusting the quote unquote experts, let alone some sort of digital expert, right?
Exactly.
So this is how they do it. It basically, it doesn't rely on hospital capacity, positive test rates, or other standard indicators that aren't able to predict the future. I mean, the ones that we have used possibly in the past. They use real-time monitoring of search terms related to coronavirus on Google, posts about the virus and conditions on Twitter and other social media, mobility data gathered from smartphones, and a number of other digital markers, they like to call it, that may suggest more people are experiencing the virus. And you might be questionable or a skeptic around this, but according to researchers, coronavirus-related searches on Twitter see a significant uptick 2 or 3 weeks in advance of increases in confirmed cases of the virus. And this similar things happen on Google Trends. So I mean, I think this is a really cool way, or interesting, not cool because we're like, yeah, like yeah. We're not in a cool time right now necessarily, but I think,
but it's technology. In the future, technology can be cool in some way.
Well, I think that the more we have to help us predict these things so we can say, okay, we need to shut down, you know, maybe communities, or we need to like go back and we need to like create more restrictions in those cities or states, like this could really possibly help.
So this is what I'm fearful of. The idea of like a system like this being used to further marginalized communities into boxes, into narratives that don't fit them. Like the narrative that this administration was trying to push on us, saying like, you know, to all the black and brown folks out there, do it for your grandmas, do it for your meemaws, all that stupid crap that they were saying. You know, I feel like there's a narrative, and even when the Los Angeles County, the mayor, I believe, posted a photo, not a photo, but of a graphic of like showing like this white lady. It's like a cartoon graphic of a white lady wearing the mask properly, but all these black and brown people wearing the mask, you know, they're negatively, they're not doing it the right way. And I feel like it continues to fuel this narrative. I just don't see how this could not be taken advantage of, especially with digital and social media culture. We've seen systems literally be infiltrated and used for another person's benefit. And for me, I feel like this could be another way to really continue to push a narrative on other, you know, communities instead of actually helping them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that once bots or hackers know that this is around, they're using something to predict X, yeah, then they could take advantage of the system.
Yeah.
The information
that research
gathered,
like anyone could.
But the information now in research gathered was based on what they saw happening, which created the result of X, which they've seen over and over again. That said, I'm interested in these models. Mm. The thing is, how do you then ensure in the future while using these models that they aren't taken advantage?
I just want to know if that model, the initial model, was created with the actual full picture of it all, right? Not this like, oh, even if it was like rooted in a problematic system, like that's not okay. That means the system is already faulty. But I'm just saying, when you look back at AI and these systems that are supposed to be doing it, they have never been in the favor of black and brown people, specifically black people. And so that's, I don't know, that's my concerns. But I do think it could possibly be helpful. But I'm also looking at the other side.
I love you're looking on the other side. At this point, we're not seeing other things work. So I'm open to anything at this point, right? Because it's like, you know, the definition of madness is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. It's not good news, God.
But sure, you're still a white woman. You wouldn't have to worry about a system tracking you down because it thinks that you're spreading COVID-19.
This is my privilege speaking, is looking at protection versus limitation.
I do think it's very interesting, though. Who knows? It's Let us know what you think at LGT Show if you found this conversation to be interesting. Who are you siding with here?
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, coming up, the EPA just approved a common household item to kill COVID-19. Find out what weapon you might have in your cabinet next in What's Trending This Hour. We are back. And before we get into What's Trending This Hour, coming up, we're going to be talking to the ACLU about the latest ICE regulations for foreign students. It's really scary. It's really crazy stuff. So stay tuned for that conversation.
It's ridiculous. Plus,
what we're not talking about when it comes to teletherapy.
Which, teletherapy is the virtual therapy, just because people can get hung up on words. But teletherapy is virtual, like everything that everyone is doing right now.
Exactly. Like, you could say this is teletherapy right now without the therapist, Ryan.
That's why
we're going crazy.
This is teletorture. This is teletorture is what I would call it. Not teletherapy.
We should actually be part of a Zoom focus group. Like, how long can you be on Zoom before you go crazy? Yeah. According to these hosts, who are on Zoom for 6 hours a day while recording this show.
Well, we did talk about possibly turning this whole Zoom situation into like a Guinness World Record, like seeing how long we could be on Zoom. I think we should do it.
You just gave away our idea.
Oh, crap. I did.
I forgot I mentioned that a long time ago.
Here's the thing. If anyone wants to do it, we will still beat their record. So it's like not even that big of a deal.
They can join us on Zoom.
Yeah. Maybe they could.
Okay. Well, let's get into some What's Trending This Hour, shall we? Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, said today he has tested positive for the coronavirus after months of downplaying its severity. He's considered like the Trump of Brazil.
He sure is.
And deaths are also mounting rapidly inside that country. Now, he's 65 years old. He's a right-wing populist. And he has also been known to mingle in crowds without covering his face. And so he is now taking hydroxychloroquine, the anti-malaria drug that he, like President Donald Trump, has been promoting, even though it has not been proven effective against COVID-19. So we'll see what happens.
Well, may the odds forever be in your favor. Go ahead and try it. Do it. That's fine. Drink the whole bottle if you want to.
Okay. Now, White House trade advisor Peter Navarro had this to say to The Hill about his experience with racism outside the White House today.
My awakening on the race issue was when I was 8 years old in a Woolworth store in West Palm Beach, Florida, when I walked over and I took a drink from the colored water fountain because I wanted to see colored water. And this woman came up to me and just gently said, "You can't drink from that." And I go, "Why?" She says, "That's for colored people." And it was like, oh yeah, I'm 8 years old, and that didn't make any sense to me. And so none of this racial divisions have made any sense to me. And you know, I'm a Californian. We don't see race out there. So you know, it's like I live my life in a race blind world, and I just it troubles me. That we have so much of this discussion when...
Okay, he's obviously not been reading about the idea of colorblindness.
Sure, he needs to take some of your training courses because this is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, the fact that he was telling this story about when he was little and wanting to drink from the colored fountain, it's weird. And then the fact that he says in California, we don't see color. Whoa, anyone that says that is a racist, people. Let's talk about it. Let's have the discussion. Let's be clear. That is what you are, and it's weird that he went on national television and said some mess like that.
Hashtag racist fact checking. Next up, Democratic Minnesota Representative Ilhan Omar is calling for the dismantling of the U.S. economy and political system. Pretty heavy stuff, and I'm interested to know how she plans to do that. She announced this in her home state of Minnesota with members of the Minnesota People of Color and Indigenous Caucus, who are coming together today to address racism and policing in the aftermath of George Floyd's death.
As long as our economy and political systems prioritize profit without considering who is profiting, who is being shut out, we will perpetuate this inequality. So we cannot stop at criminal justice system. We must begin the work of dismantling the whole system of oppression wherever we find it.
Now, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has approved two Lysol products as effective against coronavirus when used on hard, what they're calling non-porous surfaces. These products are Lysol disinfectant spray and Lysol disinfectant max cover mist, not a mask, max cover mist. They meet the agency's criteria for use against coronavirus based on lab testing that found both products kill the virus 2 minutes after contact. So go Lysol, I guess. This is not sponsored by Lysol. All right, that was what's trending this hour. Now coming up, ICE is forcing foreign students to make a choice this fall. The implications of that next in 10 minutes. Now this is messed up. The Trump administration announced yesterday new fall semester rules for foreign students, including a requirement that they take in-person classes to remain in the U.S., a condition that raised concerns as certain colleges and universities are planning to use online instruction because of the coronavirus pandemic. So if they have online instructions, they can't stay here in the U.S. And as you can imagine, it raises a lot of questions here. And back with us is Andrea Flores, Deputy Director of Immigration Policy for the ACLU. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you again for having me.
So why would they make this decision right now?
They would make this decision because it is in line with all of the decisions that they have been making during this pandemic, which is to target different groups of people just because they're currently immigrants in the United States. And that is outrageous discrimination. We've seen them ban asylum seekers at the southern border. They have banned immigrants who are eligible for green cards. This administration likes to argue that it is only concerned with, quote, illegal immigration, but they are targeting all immigrants, immigrants who are here on eligible visas and have been working and going through our immigration system for years in some cases and saying, now you're no longer eligible. You can't enter the country or you followed all of our rules, but now we're disrupting your life. So in this case, they've banned about potentially 1.2 million foreign students who are whose lives were already disrupted by this pandemic, right? Many of them already had to leave schools for the semester. Some of these students are as young as high school students. They are already under immense stress.
Yeah, because where are they living, too? Like, that's another thing. This is not their home in times. And, like, where are they living? Like, that's, like, so much there.
So the Trump administration is going after these programs of cultural exchange where students come from around the world to study in our schools and live in our communities. And they're targeting these young people who, for some of them, this is their chance to pursue their education here in the United States. Others don't come from countries that would support them continuing their education. Some don't even have online access to continue it from out of the country, we're hearing. And also, the administration is targeting universities who are already struggling to figure out how to keep professors safe and students safe. And now, if they want to protect students from deportation, which is the consequence of a policy like this, they may have to call back people to attend in person. And while we are thrilled, like Harvard announced that it would be figuring out how to, you know, accommodate people so they don't have to leave the country, how are they supposed to keep people safe that they're basically being forced by this administration to bring people back to campus instead of,
it's a huge issue. Andrea Flores again joins us, who's Deputy Director of Immigration Policy for the ACLU, as we discuss these new rules for foreign students and how, unless they're doing in-person classes, they can't be in the U.S. This is just like a huge issue, very problematic.
Yeah. Can we talk about the red flag that this really sent me when I was reading this article is about how we already know that COVID-19 is disproportionately affecting Black and brown communities and how they're saying that you have to be in person in a classroom and kind of really forgetting about all of this stuff about what's going on in the middle of a pandemic. It really shows that they're not even caring about these lives on a health front as well. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, it's a completely contradictory message from this administration. They're saying, oh, we want to get back to normal and continue everything as normal. But continuing as normal would allow foreign students to keep going to school, even if it's only online. And they're not thinking about like how much staffing the university would probably have to bring on back onto campus and bringing people together at a time when we're advised we have to keep, you're seeing spikes in you know, the Southwest and the South, disproportionately communities of color would be impacted by even a good university in really a well-intentioned university saying we want to make sure our students aren't deported, so we have to gather in person. That's wild. And it's not about the pandemic. This is a policy that you know, a xenophobic policy that white nationalist groups, they have long wanted to end foreign student visas in the United States. Like they're ending majority AAPI and other communities of color who come from around the country. And that's what this policy is really about. It's a consistent anti-immigrant agenda that they would be pursuing, I think, pandemic or not.
Yeah. And it's amazing. They talk about the economy. Well, so much of our economy is like, you're talking about over 1 million students that could contribute a lot if they're here and they're still in school and they're living their lives.
Yeah, I just keep saying they're using this pandemic as a pretext for a white nationalist immigration.
Yeah, agenda. It's so true. What,
yeah, so what's next? Where do you take it from here at the ACLU?
You know, I think the ACLU will be looking to how to support and provide guidance to universities who want to do the right thing by their students. We've called on ICE to immediately rescind this announcement. It's completely unacceptable in our perspective. And I think we'll be exploring every advocacy route because this is one of many horrific bans that have been issued in the last 3 months. And now like the numbers, we're in like the hundreds and thousands and now, you know, adding 1 million foreign students of groups we're advocating for and arguing that Congress needs to investigate because Trump has far exceeded his authority and Congress needs to look at the justifications.
All right.
Different policies.
Well, Andrea Flores, thank you so much again for joining us for this and for all the work you're doing right now. This is just unbelievable, really.
Well, thank you for covering this issue.
Again, Andrea is the Deputy Director of Immigration Policy for the ACLU. Now, coming up, therapy has gone virtual during COVID-19. I mean, we both know, me and Ryan are in it to win it. So will people even return to in-person visits after this? That's next. Let's get into a conversation about teletherapy, virtual therapy. I mean, I'm in it. I have a therapy session this afternoon.
I do it every once in a while. I've actually really enjoyed it. It's been kind of like my saving grace during this time.
Yeah, me too. Well, back in March, only 2 or 3% of Americans got mental health treatment online. But thanks to everything happening right now, or fortunately, unfortunately, that number is now like 100%.
Wow.
So while teletherapy is creating accessibility, is it as good as in-person visits? And will we ever get back to that? Back with us is clinical psychologist, Dr. Josh Klapo. Thanks again for being here for this.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Yeah, this is a, I'm going to say it, it's an unprecedented time in telemental health. And it's a very, it's something that before the pandemic, we in the mental health community have been pushing and pushing and pushing for with regard to licensure and reimbursement and all those kinds of things, because there are a lot of people who don't have good access to mental health. So this has sort of pushed that to the forefront. It's fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. And I wonder, do you think we're going to change our definition of essential workers, right? In the sense of like, I feel like mental health should be being put in the forefront and therapists and psychologists and these, you know, professionals should really be like, this is essential work that needs to be done, especially at a time like this.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, from an insurance standpoint, so if you're talking about psychologists or mental health providers who are providing services where insurance is paying, this is considered essential, right? It is frontline. And I know that there's lots of other therapists and other sorts of allied support, but Ryan, you're absolutely right. And in fact, in some states, and I can't speak to all the states, but in some states, some of the insurers are waiving right now because of the declaration of state of emergency, waiving all co-pays. I mean, you have to have the insurance, but they're waiving all co-pays. And they're keeping this telemental health in place until, well, for the unforeseeable future. So it's unprecedented access. But that being said, there are a lot of people who have been in therapy and now for the first time are seeing the same psychologist or therapist in a telehealth modality. And that can be a little challenging or different. There's some barriers that have to be overcome there as well. Yeah.
Again, we're talking to clinical psychologist, Dr. Josh Klapo, about teletherapy or virtual therapy. So how important is it to be in the same room as a patient versus what you're doing now?
I think in an ideal situation, you want to be in the same room, because where it can fall off is, number one, the quality of the technology. And we've all experienced this now, the breakups and the freezing of the frames and the sound and all that. The second thing, though, that I think is really important is not all mental health providers are used to engaging in front of a screen and a camera. And so some of that connection, depending on the provider, can be lost. Similarly, on the flip side, and this is not just on the mental health provider, but on the patient and the client, they may be less comfortable talking to a camera. And so when those pieces kind of come into play, potentially you lose something. Now, that being said, I want to be real clear. The research on this is pretty clear. Relative to not being able to have it at all or not do therapy at all, this is far better.
Yeah.
The telemental health. So I don't want to give the message that unless you're in the room, you're not getting it.
No. And I get that, but I do think, you know, now we're forced to see that how well it works, but why do you think people were so skeptical about it in the past, this teletherapy?
Yeah, I think a couple things. I think one, just comfort with the technology on both sides, provider and patient. Two, reimbursement issues, Ryan. There's a lot of issues about whether someone can get reimbursed for a teleservice or not. So it's just the finances. And then I think the third piece too, and you hear about this a lot, patients or clients in particular wanting to have a place that they feel safe in the way that's not, they feel safe in their home, but feeling safe in a, you know, locked office where nobody else can bother them. That I think has made patients more hesitant, much more so than providers.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I would think that if you're having a really honest session and you don't have anywhere to go in your home, and then you're crying, and you don't want your family or anyone around you, your colleagues to see, like you're a mess afterwards. It can be embarrassing, or issues for that.
And just quickly share the other thing. If you think about it, when you go see your psychologist, your therapist, that is a safe physical environment, right? So there's no trick. If you got family problems, relationship problems, and you're sitting in the same bedroom where your significant other is gaslighting you, then it becomes a weird, weird experience. But again, let me underscore, relative to no therapy at all, this is one of the greatest gifts, if there are any, of this pandemic, is that people who have mental health problems and challenges can get care in a much easier way than they could before.
And I know, according to this Vice article, maybe there's been less cancellations, which is a big deal. And they also provided all these incredible stats, like 65% of the rural counties in America have no psychiatric treatment available at all. So like, that's huge. Imagine the limitations around that. And only about half the people who need mental health treatment in America actually get it. And of course, those numbers drop even lower for marginalized groups. Once again, the importance of accessibility here. Do you think this is going to be a trend we're going to see continue? Do you think some of your clients won't want to necessarily see you in person anymore?
No, what I hope, my hope is that the insurance companies and the payers that reimburse will get on board with this, because that's what's going to drive it, share more than anything else. I want my patients and my clients to be happy and comfortable, whether that's in office or not office. We as mental health providers are okay either way.
All right. And we get to judge you for what you have in your room too.
Hey,
look. Talks about that judgment of what's in your Zoom. All right. Dr. Josh Klapo, thanks again for joining us as usual.
Thank you.
Now coming up, Texas is just now considering real sexual health education in its schools, how that could impact the next generation, coming up next. Sex education in Texas might be changing very soon. Now, what was sex ed like for you, Ryan?
So sex ed for me was very traditional. I grew up in the Bible Belt, so it was very heteronormative. I feel like I talked about Speedy the Sperm on this show, where my sex ed teacher bought in the stuffings of a pillowcase and put little beady eyes on it and shaped it in a sperm-like shape and showed what happened. I mean, I've also learned about HPV in that way. It was very heteronormative. There was nothing there that talked about queerness. A lot of the stuff that I had to find out about sex education came from, unfortunately, porn and my friends, my community, like in when I actually stepped foot into the queer community. So
that's what we call hands-on education.
It wasn't even, that was a lot about that, right?
But, you know, with me, because I am older than you, in Canada, we had moral social development, MSD. And like, all I remember is that banana condom thing. But besides that, it was more about getting to know yourself versus other people. Like, I don't really remember that much.
Yeah, ours was called teen living. Ours wasn't called that. Ours was teen living.
Well, I find this pretty wild how in Texas, nearly 80% of public schools still teach children and teens abstinence or no sex education at all. Mm-mm. And now experts believe, and they're saying that lack of evidence-based education is responsible for the state having one of the highest teen pregnancy rates in the country. So it seems like what they're doing is not working. Creating this culture that sex is taboo and should be shamed is not helping the cause.
I mean, here's the thing. Once you tell kids not to do something, they're going to want to do it. They're going to feel more enticed to do it. So you should be teaching kids, here's the safe way of doing these things, and here's why you should take your time into doing these things and actually having an open conversation.
Yeah, well, I'll get to their proposed changes, but I've been reading, as you know, I've been talking about my fave Esther Perel, who's a very known therapist. She's an expert in erotic intelligence. I'm reading Mating in Captivity right now, this book. And actually, there is a chapter talking about how, you know, sex has become so taboo in America compared to Europe, and how that even starts when we're obviously younger culturally, how there's these campaigns like in Europe, safe sex or no sex, whereas in the US, it's like, not me, not now. So, and they've shown that despite actually Europe being more open, it's the US that has teens having sex earlier and more teen pregnancy.
So wait, are you saying, and I just want to clarify, you saying the U.S. is the one that is more open?
Not me, not now.
They're not open.
No, they're like, they're not open. And whereas we have other countries, idea that just because you're open and you give accessibility, that that's going to make kids and teens like run to make it happen.
Oh, yeah.
And just, you know, you're creating more of a curiosity exploration. And definitely I'm sure that's there because teens are curious. But in the end, by not giving them the right information, you're actually probably causing an increase, not just in pregnancy, but probably in STDs as well.
I mean, yeah, but in this the sense of even when you're talking about queerness, I think queer people are already told that their sex is bad. It's blasphemous. And I had to get out of my weird connection, my own kind of internalized hate for homosexual sex, because I felt like it was unnatural, it wasn't needed. And also I was nervous around it. I was uncomfortable because felt like, you know, these feelings that you're feeling, you're told that those are all wrong. And so even when it comes into the idea of like for queer people and for queer kids that are trying to navigate this, I wish there is more of a space where there is education from it, because a lot of the times you are finding out from your community around you. And oftentimes that information coming from that community is not right. You're learning in hand. And so it can be very detrimental for someone's health if they're not doing it the right way. And there just needs to be an openness about this.
Well, in Texas, the proposed changes would include the idea to provide instruction about condoms and other methods of pregnancy prevention. And they even have this program that's Abstinence Plus curriculum that mentions these contraceptive methods like condoms and to prevent the spread of STDs or pregnancy. Anyway,
this literally proves it, though. It literally proves that even this conversation, like even the information we have, is wrapped in heteronormativity. You know, it's not even really there for queer individuals. And so, yeah, that's really what I would want to see change.
So it's either going to be in schools or something known as Google. So best of luck with that. Now, coming up, Florida schools are set to reopen regardless of COVID spikes, but why, we find out next with What's Trending This Hour. We are back. And just a reminder, you want to stay tuned and listen to our Yas Queen of the Day, because we have the founder of these gender inclusive sex toys joining us. And they raise like a ton of money on Kickstarter. Really inspiring story. So stay tuned for that later this hour.
And honey, you didn't even get, you won't get to see the private tour of the sex toys that we got. We got like our own little sex toy class. We got to see what they look like and all that stuff. It was nice.
Yes. I mean, I'm down for the cause. Okay. Let's get into some what's trending this hour. Now, President Donald Trump addressed the nation today and discussed schools reopening.
We want to reopen the schools. Everybody wants it. The moms want it. The dads want it. The kids want it. It's time to do it. You know, our mortality rate is right now at a level that people don't talk about, but it's down tenfold. So you look at deaths are way down from this horrible China virus, and it's a disgrace that it happened. Shouldn't have happened, but it did. And the economy is coming back, and it's coming back strongly. Jobs are setting records. For 2 months ago, they set the record, and then again.
Well, that's one way to put it. Yeah, of course, everyone wants things to go back, and you know, and it's time to do it. Is it? Like, you know, you have no strategy.
Did you just ask, is it time to do it? No, I think it's, yeah, and most definitely everyone wants to go back, especially like you said this yesterday, that kids are probably the only people right now that want to get back to school, and probably the parents want them back at school. But I think also people are worried about how they're going to do it safely. Teachers are trying to figure out. And so, and schools are trying to figure it out altogether. So I don't know. He's just always rushing. It feels like he's not even paying attention to the surges that are happening.
Yeah, it's probably how he does a lot of things in his life. He just rushes through it.
Ew, that is nasty.
All right, let's move on. Florida. All right. Meanwhile, in Florida, the new U.S. hotspot for coronavirus, they're going to require schools to reopen in August. Seems like they're following President Trump here. The state's commissioner of the Department of Education, Richard Corcoran, issued an emergency order yesterday requiring all brick and mortar schools to open at least 5 days per week for all students. Remember, Florida initially avoided the worst of the pandemic in its first few months. They now have the third highest number of cases in the U.S. at 206,000 and counting. So under that order, schools must reopen in full. School districts will need to submit a reopening plan that satisfies the requirements of the new emergency order to the Department of Education. So at least there's going to be some sort of requirements there. Now, finally, let's get to this tea about this book written by President Trump's niece, Mary Trump, where she's making a lot of claims in her memoir, Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man.
Shira, I have to, one, pause you, because you have been hanging around me for way too long. The way you just slid into, let's get into this tea. We can't move on without acknowledging that.
Like the sleigh god here.
You're just becoming me.
Slay Shira.
No, Shira's trying to just be another black woman in America. No, I love it. That was hilarious.
A black queen like you. Okay, let's talk about what she reveals in this book because it's pretty juicy. And actually, DailyMail.com got their hands on the book ahead of its release. They're trying to take her to court to stop the release of the book. It seems to be not working because it's somehow going to get out there. We all know this. But here's what she reveals. That Donald Trump suffered child abuse at the hands of his father. That love meant nothing to Fred Trump Sr. and he only wanted obedience, which the president was forced to give him. Now, Donald's mother became ill when he was just 2 years old. We all know what happens when you don't have a mother figure and like, you know, how you deal with the opposite sex when that happens. You don't know how to have functional relationships.
Yeah, but we're not psychologists.
I've been taught this. I've been taught this through therapy. That left him with total dependence on a caregiver, Fred Sr., who also caused him terror. Neglected by his workaholic father, she claims that the president suffered deprivations that would scar him for life. And she describes Donald as Frankenstein's monster.
Whoa. I mean, this is some explosive stuff, and we have not heard, you know, of this someone in the family actually that isn't like up Trump's woo-ha. You know, it's like we haven't heard from them. We've only heard from like, you know, his siblings. And so to know that there's someone inside of the castle that wants to just reveal all, I'm here for it. It's going to be interesting.
Oh, yeah.
If this book even gets to be released. But we'll see.
But there's enough coming out at this point, and I think it's in the hands of a lot of people, so.
Yeah, we'll see.
Supposedly, also, Trump hired someone to do the SATs for him.
Oh, my gosh. Are you kidding me?
Okay. That was what's trending this hour, but a perfect segue into the T-Report.
All right. So coming up in the T-Report, we got to give an update about Halle Berry's latest backlash about a role that she was considering. And we got to talk about this congressional hopeful out of Florida who thinks Beyonce is an Italian woman and is actually just pretending to be African-American. Yep. That's a mess. We're diving in. Don't go anywhere. And we are back with the T Report. You know those pop culture entertainment stories that you probably missed out on, but honey, guess what? We got you covered. Now, let's start off with an update about yesterday's story. Y'all, I told you I had a bone to pick with Halle Berry because she was talking about how she was going to play this trans role in a new movie, and she got so much critiques, and a lot of backlash came her way, but I have to say, she handled it so classy and so, like, I guess how an ally should. She immediately issued an apology, saying, over the weekend, I had the opportunity to discuss my consideration of an upcoming role as a transgender man, and I like to apologize for those remarks. As a cisgender woman, I now understand that I should not have considered this role, and that the transgender community should undeniably have the opportunity to tell their own stories. Bravo, Halle Berry. That is how you listen and take criticism and you move forward.
That was quick.
It was very quick. Honestly, it was actually her apology happened probably after I told the story on yesterday's show. It was wild. Didn't even know. But we're going to move on to the fun part of this T-Report today. I have to say it's involving Beyonce. So, you know, this congressional hopeful, K.W. Miller, he took to Twitter to tell his 17,000 followers on the 4th of July that the singer's real name, that Beyonce's real name was this, Anne Marie Lestrousi.
Okay.
So basically, he proclaimed this. He said, Beyonce is not even a real African-American. She's faking this for exposure. Okay. So this conspiracy theory appeared, I guess, to have some type of joke on social media last week. It was using a picture of a Big Brother candidate, a Big Brother competitor. Her name is Rachel White as Anne Marie. But Miller, however, who is actually running for Congress in Florida's 18th congressional district in November, believes that there is so much more and there's some truth to this actual story. And the funny thing is, once this happened and the internet was just going wild over it because it's so stupid, a website called The Root, they actually got an exclusive interview with the real Anne Marie Lestrousi, who said this, and she actually is kind of very witty. She said, because they asked her, like, how's your life changed during this whole thing? And she said, well, if she were truly Italian, she probably would have picked a Versace dress while getting into formation instead of Givenchy. Also, the only time I'm in a deep state is when I'm planning Beyonce-themed dinners. Popular dishes, of course, is baked cantini and drunken linguine. I also have a wonderful wine collection called Yonce All on His Mouth Like Vino. Oh, she's very witty. It was to be honest, that article read like fan fiction, but I can't believe there's someone in Congress that actually believes this because I think their political career just fell a little short.
This is so weird. I'm trying to, obviously he deleted the tweet. He's this like older white guy.
Yeah.
You know, and he tweets so much. I could barely even scroll down to July 4th because he tweets like every hour.
It's embarrassing for this guy, in all honesty. It's very embarrassing. Let's move on to Lin-Manuel Miranda. You know, Hamilton has been a big conversation starter right now because of the Hamilton film. But people are actually being critical of it. You know, he has actually had to respond to the criticism that Hamilton mishandles slavery. You know, the issue that is surrounding that whole story. And so here's what he said in criticism to this. He said, all the criticisms are valid. He says basically that the sheer tonnage of complexities and failings of these people I couldn't get or wrestled with but cut. I took 6 years and fit as much as I could in 2.5 hour musical. Did my best. It's all fair in game.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's pretty aware of these things. It's not like he himself is unaware of the atrocities and the other side of the story. I just think, you know, if you even look at it, you know, you have the other members of the cast and everyone's of different races and backgrounds, obviously, as part of the cast. But I mean, it wasn't a big thing that they focused on. that's that.
I mean, there's one part in there that I guess is everyone saying, like, it kind of occasionally popped up, was when Hamilton confronts Thomas Jefferson about how the South built its strong economy on the backs of slaves. And so there's like that one moment. But that was basically it. And yeah, just because the cast is diverse doesn't mean that you couldn't handle that or like say something about it. I think it's, you can't.
And they bring up immigrants and how obviously like it's built on the backs of immigrants.
If you look at the actual story of Alexander Hamilton, they're talking about immigrants in the very European perspective, but it just means different things when you have a cast of diverse people on stage. Well, if you want to know more about that story, head over to WeAreChannelQ.com and keep us followed at LGT Show Everywhere.
Now coming up, the mission to create gender-inclusive sex toys. That's next in our Yas Queen of the Day. Are you intrigued? I hope so. It is time for our Yas Queen of the Day.
Yes, Queen.
Okay, four words. Gender-neutral sex toys. How does that sound?
Shira, I am absolutely... where can I place my order? Because I need it.
Well, I've been needing this for a few months, actually. So we want to give our Yas Queen of the Day to these sex toys. They're called Cute Little Effers. We can't say the full word. They're high-quality collectible vibrators.
Yes.
Shaped like adorable monsters, each with their own names, pronouns, and webcomic stories. They're actually designed by artists for use on all bodies and identities. And they actually raised a bunch of money, I believe, on a fundraising platform.
Which we'll find more about, of course.
And we have the founder here to talk more about Cute Little Effers right now. Steph, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on. I am so honored, so excited to be here to share what feel like my queer, wonderful, ridiculous babies with the world and with you.
You know, it's so interesting because when I looked at the website, I was like, oh my God, this reminds me if like Lady Gaga in the Fame Monster era was a sex toy, then this is what would happen. Like, it really makes me very excited. So how did it all start? Break that down for us. Take us there.
This whole thing started when me and a bunch of friends, we were just hanging out in my room, goofing around, and someone mentioned Pokemon sex toys, and someone was like, "Hi, I'd buy that," and then someone's like, "I'd buy that." I'm like, "Yeah, I'd totally buy that," and we were just joking, and suddenly I'm like, wait, this is a real need. Because like we were talking about just how sterile so many sex toys felt. Mm-hmm. They felt like they were designed by like NASA engineers trying to shoot something into space rather than, you know, make something fun and relatable. Also, as someone who is non-binary, I identify as gender fluid, just was really hard to find sex toys that were affirming of my gender identity. Really, surprisingly, very hard. And so that's what got this idea stuck into my mind. It was itching in my mind for about a year. And then a year later, I actually had a huge shift in my life where I ended up having these really intense chronic health issues that I'm still battling today, almost 2 years later. And I had to leave my career and was like, what do I do with my life now? And I'm like, you know what? Now's the time for these sex toys in the world, and kind of took that turning point to build this thing that I felt like was really needed. And even if no one else loved it, I sure as hell was really excited about the idea. And I quickly found out I wasn't alone in that.
Yeah. And sometimes that's the best way to start something. If you yourself would need it, then you know there's others out there. And again, we are talking to the founder of Cute Little Effers. We once again can't say the word, but you know what it is, Step. And now tell us about these gender inclusive sex toys. You started a fundraiser around, actually.
Yeah, so it started with a Kickstarter campaign, which was actually a whole endeavor in itself, because Kickstarter normally doesn't allow adult toys on their platform. Before, they hadn't let an adult toy on their platform in over 7 years.
Wow.
So getting them to change their mind on that was a really long journey. It took about 7 months of communication with them. It was very hot and cold. Very like, oh, this sort of like creator story and this inclusivity is exactly what Kickstarter is all about. And then they were like, oh, but adult toys, even though there was nothing in their official rules. And it was this very hot, cold, hot, cold, hot, cold. And finally, I was like, it's time. I need to launch this now. I can't push it back anymore. Like, I need to launch within a month. Like, I need your okay. And their ticker was leaning towards a no. And so I wrote actually a public, or not, I wrote a private letter to the company that was like, this is not just about, you know, product on your platform. This is really about how you show up for the queer community. And then, you know, one day I just got the generic, like, your campaign's been approved email.
Wow. And so how much money did you raise, Step?
And it was we ended up raising three times our goal, about $35,000.
Yes.
Which was incredible.
Oh, wow.
We hit our goal in the first day, which I was not expecting.
Wow, that is huge.
In the first day. I mean, that really shows the need for this. Like, people were like, yes, we've been looking for a product like this forever.
It was so affirming. I mean, that's why I wanted to do Kickstarter in the first place, because it takes a lot of money to build a product into the world. It takes a lot of big question marks, whether people want it or not. And so for me, it was sort of like, this was going to be the sign of whether I should drive forward and build this and bring it to the world, or whether I was the only one who wanted it.
Well, Step, this is so great. How can people get one of their own? Are they out yet? What's going on?
Absolutely. So they are finally here. I just finished delivering all of the Kickstarter toys last week. The website has just gone up for, now for everyone to go. I'm just so stoked that for this month, we're even doing free shipping to anyone in the US.
Okay.
Really exciting. Just, you know, help people relieve some of the stress that the recent times have been putting into all of us. And so you can do that by cutelittleeffers.com, or also, if you don't want to type in profanity into your URL, clftoys.com.
Well, Step, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your story. Really inspiring.
Yes.
Thank you so much for having me. This, I'm honored. Y'all are great.
Aww. Well, you get our Yes Queen of the Day.
Yes, Queen.
Now coming up, the Pride Parade we didn't know we needed. That's next in our Made My Day moment. We are wrapping up the show today, as usual, with our hashtag Made My Day moment, where we share something that we found on social media that made our day. Well, Pride Month is over.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't mean we can't continue celebrating Pride. And all of us have different ways to celebrate. Now, Willem, who we love, and Heidi and Closet hosted Grindr's Pride Puppy Parade. How about that?
I mean, this is the cutest thing I've ever seen. And honestly, I don't know why it wasn't in my life before this moment, because I really need this to survive. It's so cute.
Now, here are some highlights.
Next up is Precious Pupper Jackhammer, an 11-year-old gender fluid mutt who's here to raise the wolf.
Looking like she passed out in her kibble after her brunch shift at Mary's. Put on the mix.
Isn't that where I met you?
Probably. Here we have Baxter, a British bulldog who loves to eat, pray, sleep, and love. In that order.
Oh, Baxter.
Baxter.
For Pride, this good boy has given us leather bare rims.
He sits and he stays. Give me a doggy bag, I'll take him to go. He has not even...
Those dogs, great looks, and I love the commentary.
I mean, yeah, because obviously this is an audible program, so the audience can't see the dogs. But the dogs were very, very cute. Take our word for it, or you can go check out the video. I loved getting Coco a little Pride t-shirt this year, even though it's not like she could have went to a Pride march or anything. But she still represented, and I...